Alrighty, friends. Greg Kokel here, and the show is Stand to Reason, and thank you for being my listening guests today. Everybody's going to be a listening guest because we have no talking guests. We just have one talking head, and that would be yours truly in this show. And I'll tell you what's happened. A number of weeks ago, I did a Facebook Live, which didn't go that well. I mean, my contribution was brilliant, but there was all kinds of trouble with Facebook, and we had the sound dropping out every couple of minutes. We had the picture flickering. We got knocked off their platform a few times. They had to jump back in, and so I thought, forget about that. We're going to cover the same ground again in a reliable podcast. And so I'm looking at my colleague Derek, and he is reliably podcasting from his end. And so I think this will be a much better shot at the material I wanted to cover than last time around. And actually, it's better in some ways because more people will be able to hear the thoughts I have on these series of questions that were put on social media and we had in the queue for that question answering Facebook event. And I think there's four or five of them here, probably take up most of the show to cover them this hour. And so let's get at it. The first question starts with simple yes or no question here. Yeah, right. I don't do that. That's not my style. Anyway, the question says, given everything that you've studied and all the arguments you have considered, would you say it's impossible for there not to be a God? Or would you go that far to say, through sound reasoning, personal experience, and any other way you have of discerning truth, that there must be a God? And then adds, your God. Okay. Now, just for the record, I honestly don't trust my personal experience as part of the equation, at least in my, generally in my own confidence in the existence of God. And I'm not saying that because I don't think that there's a legitimate case to be made there, and philosophers had made that case. Just that, especially in my case, the personal experience strikes me as the least reliable element. I am, you know, just to be candid, I am one of those guys for 46 years who I would say, and I'm not trying to wave my flag here, I'm just identifying a different style here, have followed hard after God. And that means that I'm just going to keep putting one foot in front of the other, no matter what the circumstances hold for me, or no matter how I feel at the moment. And it's a way of acknowledging, I think, that the feelings are the kinds of things that come and go. As you know, I mean, this is not profound. And this is true in all relationships, not just our relationship with God. And C.S. Lewis talks about it in the, let's see, which one is that? The one about the devil's Screwtape Letters. Then he talks about the fact that human beings are creatures that have one foot in eternity and one foot in time, as the way he puts it at least. And therefore, the closest they come to stability is undulation. They go up, they go down. They go up, they go down. They go up, they go down. And that's certainly true of me. And in terms of, I'm straining for a word here. In terms of a kind of a vigorous emotional engagement with God, this isn't the kind of thing that happens in a robust way on a regular basis. Okay, I am constantly, after a fashion, aware of the presence of God, but I don't feel like I'm getting touched by God a lot. Now, for some of you, this will seem odd because that's not your life. And for others of you, this will be an encouragement when you hear me say this, because you've been wondering, gee, if I'm really a Christian, why aren't more things happening for me emotionally? And I've talked about this at different times on shows and why that's the case and why people are different. I won't go into the details now, but just to say in light of this question that the idea of personal experience is not, if what one means is subjective awareness, is not one of those things that is a powerful factor in my case for God personally. I guess personal experience could also be dramatic prayers that have been answered or dramatic things that happen in one's life that have the fingerprints of God all over them, and those things have happened for me. I will say, though, more in the distant past than recently, it seems, particularly when I was a fairly new Christian, and I think this just happens. When we become Christians, there's a kind of a honeymoon period if we become Christians as adults, and lots of intensive things seem to happen. And then things change a bit, and the honeymoon's over, and we get down to real living and real change and that kind of stuff. Lewis talks about this as well. So this is not odd, but I can think back early on about some very, very incredible things that happened that were strong evidences, subjectively, experientially, of God's hand in my life. And those were, of course, really significant encouragements to me of his presence. However, the answer I want to give is in different areas. So it has to do with my level of confidence of God's existence in light of the, everything I've studied, the arguments that I've considered. Would I go as far as to say it's impossible for there not to be a God? And I guess I'd have to say I'm pretty close to that point. I remember in my debate with Michael Shermer a number of years ago on Hugh Hewitt's national radio broadcast, 3 hours with the American atheist Michael Shermer, Skeptic Magazine editor, founder. And I closed out the show with a comment. And the comment was that I basically summed up my general attitude about atheism versus theism here as in this way. I said, it's virtually impossible for me to will myself to be an atheist. Pardon me. And the answer is, I know too much. I would have to commit myself to what seemed to me wildly counterintuitive notions. I would have to commit myself to the notion, I said, that the universe came from nothing. Okay. Contrary to evidence that relates to a cosmological argument. I would have to commit myself to all of the design in the universe or apparent design to being complete accident. I would have to commit myself to the notion that life came from non-life and that morality is not objective, but just a relativistic trick of Darwinian evolution. I would have to commit myself to the idea that consciousness just sprang up spontaneously from matter and on, that these factors or these elements that are part of reality that are explained in, to me, completely persuasive ways by the existence of God, I would have to simply acknowledge are unexplainable by anything but natural law and the circumstances of a closed universe of cause and effect. And to be honest with you, this is just beyond my capability to even countenance. In fact, I have a hard time understanding how atheists are so easily dismiss these things and are so easily satisfied with the kinds of alternate explanations that naturalists give that I just made reference to. That the universe came into existence out of nothing, with no cause, for no reason, and no purpose, no transcendent purpose. That morality, that it's not wrong to rape. Now, atheists would admit that we say it's wrong because evolutionists taught us to say it's wrong. But you realize this is an entirely different kind of thing than saying the rape itself is wrong, because the evolutionary explanation focuses not on the action or the object in the world, but rather on the subject, that is, the belief an individual has about the action. And that belief is one created, apparently, by evolution. I'm not sure that evolution can, even the Darwinian process as we understand it, can create beliefs. I'm not at all convinced of that. But that would have to be the case, and only that would be the explanation for what we call morality. It would be just a sophisticated relativistic morality, not an objectivistic morality, which simply means that we are tricked by our genes into believing rape was wrong when there is nothing right or wrong about rape itself at all, or any other action for that matter. Okay, and that's what I'm left with on an atheistic view of reality. And I have not mischaracterized the view at all. There are very, very few, you'll almost never meet one, who believes that morality is objective. At least they will not say they believe it in conversation, because it doesn't fit their worldview. That morality is objective. Instead, they're going to say things like Richard Dawkins did, that, you know, some get lucky, some don't. And, you know, there is no right, there is no wrong. It's nothing but blind, pitiless, no evil, no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And it would be. There would be indifference, because there's nothing to have an attitude out there for us, and therefore there's no pity. It's pitiless. And there is no right and there is no wrong, for fully consistent with his materialism. These things, even individually, even one of them individually, is powerful. But taken as a group, these notions that somehow atheism has a better answer is completely beyond me. And when I say better, I don't mean more satisfying. It's like, well, that's not satisfying, so it's not the right answer. I'm not talking about satisfaction in an emotional sense. I'm talking about the facts. I'm talking about the capability of explaining the world as it really is. Which story of reality seems more accurate in light of reality? And going right down, I just gave you the three. I guess I made reference to more, but the three basic arguments for God's existence are the cosmological argument, and that is the argument based on the existence of the universe. Why is something here rather than nothing here, is a general way of putting it, and I think that's a fair question. And there are different forms of this argument. Leibniz had one. The one most people are familiar with is the Kalam, which William Lane Craig has revived, an ancient argument that Muslims used and made popular, and I think this is profound. And I have simplified somewhat, for some people, complex argument, all things that come into existence have a cause, the universe came into existence, therefore the universe has a cause. I mean, there it is. There's the syllogism, and it's a valid syllogism, and if the premises are true, and they seem to be, then the syllogism is sound. And so there is a proof for God that seems reliable. But a simpler way to put it is the way I often put it, and that is a big bang needs a big banger. Okay, that pretty much covers that ground, and that seems intuitively correct. And the alternatives are highly unlikely. And when you're dealing with something like God and all the ramifications of that, and you want to be rational, then rationality requires you go with the odds-on favorite. But that's just one of the arguments, the cosmological argument. Then you have the teleological argument. Teleological comes from the Greek telos, T-E-L-O-S, and a telos is an end or a purpose. And the point of the teleological argument is it just seems like that things were made for a purpose. And of course, if they were made for a purpose, there has to be a purposer. Okay? And so I have a multitude of objects on my desk right now. Here's some of them are very, very simple. I have this little device with a hinge on it and some sharp points on it, and it is, if someone were to ask me, what is that? What is that made for, is what they have in mind, because they can see quite clearly that it is an artifact. It is designed to do something in particular. It has a telos. It has an end. It has a purpose. What is the purpose? In this case, it's to remove staples. You squeeze the sharp points around the staples, and you pull. And it pulls a staple out. Okay? So there you have an artifact, and our lives are filled with artifacts that we recognize as such. As Doug Axe has said, we have an intuition that he calls the design intuition that allows us to intuit when things are made for a purpose. And by the way, if that were not possible, then archaeology would not be possible, because archaeology requires, and paleontology for that matter, that we look at things that are physical things and infer from their features that they are artifacts, that is, designed by an agent for a purpose. See that little flint stone? Notice how it's chip, 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 chip from the center to the outside, and it makes a nice, even, very sharp edge. And it goes all around in a shape that you can hold in your hand. That's pretty obviously made as a scraper to scrape probably hides or something like that, or to cut things, all right? They are inferring from the physical object a design to it. Perfectly normal. We have this capability. And in fact, when we look at the natural world, we see all kinds of things that seem to be that way, that seem to be made for a particular purpose. It has a telos, an end. And so there's the teleological argument. Now, just like with the kalam or some forms of the cosmological argument, there have been rebuttals. People have made attempts to dismiss these arguments. In fact, later on today, I have, for this session, I have another question about fine-tuning, which is an example of the teleological argument, and I'll get to that. But it strikes me that the dismissals are shallow and inadequate to explain the evidence. And that's the judgment call everybody has to face. But that's the cosmological argument. That's the teleological argument. And then you have the moral argument. And I've made reference to this already. That there are things that are objectively wrong, that there is evil in the world. And by the way, everybody knows that. Doesn't matter where you lived or when you live. Everybody knows that something's wrong with the world. And when we say something's wrong with the world, we mean it's morally problematic. Something is morally wrong. That thing that just happened, that ain't right. This is what we say. We say it automatically and without even thinking, because we behold the moral impropriety of the circumstances, and we react to it, we respond to it. Why do we do that? Well, some want to say that just we're not responding to anything other than a set of circumstances that mindless evolution has caused us to respond to because it helps us to get our genes into the next generation. Makes it kind of hard to explain why people think rape is wrong on that explanation when you think about it. But in any event, there's an alternate explanation. I don't think that's the best explanation. I think that people think that something's wrong with the world because something is wrong with the world. And it's wrong with the world. That is, the wrong is out there in the objective realm. People do bad things. That means they break laws. And if they break laws that are transcendent, that means they're universals, they apply to everybody, they're out there, they're not dependent on our minds. Just like gravity is not dependent on our minds. If we don't believe in gravity, we're not going to float away, all right? It's a feature of the real world. And morality seems to be a feature of the real world. That's why we hold people responsible to morality, even when they don't agree with us that what they've done was wrong. Famously, the war crimes, Nuremberg war crimes in the, tribunals regarding war crimes in the Second World War. Okay, there were differences about what was right or wrong, but as the tribunal held, there is a law above the law. There's a higher law. And this just seems obvious to everyone, even though there are some people who deny it. It is obvious in their behaviors and in their reactions. And this is what I talk about when I talk about how to respond to the issue of relativism. Nobody really believes it. Moral relativism is what I'm referring to now. Nobody really believes it. They know there are rights and wrongs, and even when they try to deny it, they'll affirm it. They'll say, there is no right and wrong, therefore it's wrong for you to push your morality on me. You hear the contradiction there? Why do they say that? Because they can't get away from who they are, made in the image of God, and part of that entails that they are moral creatures capable of seeing the moral law written in their world and on their hearts. Okay, if there's a moral law that's written, somebody had to write it. And therefore, ergo, the moral argument for God. If there is no God, there is no objective morality. But there is objective morality, and that's evidenced by the clear and obvious problem of evil. Therefore, there is a God. That's the moral argument. It's a valid argument. That is, it has the right form. It's a modus tollens form. And it seems the premises are true. Because you can't have a moral law without a moral law maker. Therefore, if there's no God, there's no morality, objective morality. But we know there's objective morality. That seems to be true, too, based on the problem of evil. So when I offer these three types of arguments, and as I mentioned and referred to earlier, there are more of them, it seems, gosh, it just, I don't know, for my money, those are pretty potent. And for me to deny the legitimacy of those and opt for the alternative that atheistic belief offers is to abandon my mind and to engage irrationality, which strikes me as ironic in light of the fact that the atheists are the ones who claim to be the reasonable, rational people. They're not going with they're free thinkers. They're going to let reason dictate what they believe, not some kind of authority. Okay, well, here it is. I just gave three kinds of arguments that are powerful and compelling. And incidentally, what's, I think, an additional strength of those three arguments is they all have the same answer. There's a unified way of looking at the answer to those issues. It isn't like, well, we can go here, or we can go here, we can go here, we can go here, and we have all these different ad hoc, maybe, explanations for the peculiarities of the world, when in fact I can provide an answer that unifies them all and makes perfect sense. In fact, it's the one who makes the most sense. And so the fact that there's a unification here adds strength, I think, to the power of it. Which means when I know what I know here, I do not see how it's possible for there not to be a God. In answer to the question, which wasn't simple, yes or no, obviously, 24 minutes later, I don't think it's possible for there not to be a God. Now, of course, that's a judgment call, but it's based on very particular reasons, which makes it all the more mystifying to me when I hear atheists fairly consistently proclaim, I don't believe in God because there is no evidence. There is no evidence. There just is no evidence. Really, 98% of the people in the world believe in something for which there is no evidence? Are you kidding me? Now, I think really what this amounts to is that they don't mean there is no evidence, but there's no evidence that persuades them. Oh, okay. Well, I can get that, but that's not the same as not being any evidence at all. There's lots of evidence. Okay, and at least I, for one, have been persuaded by the evidence. There is one other detail here, and that is your God. What about your God? There must be a God, your God. Well, that's a whole nother element. And all the things that I gave you so far are evidence for a God that is outside of the natural realm, that is adequate to be the moral standard of the universe, and is pretty smart to design things the way he designed them so they fit together so wonderfully to accomplish particular ends. And by the way, I didn't even touch on the DNA triple helix, double helix rather, and all of the massive amounts of language, linguistic information that is stored there in the DNA molecule. That's a whole nother element of design. And the fine-tuned parameters of the universe, which I'll make a comment about in a little bit because there's a question on that. All of this is all part of that. Okay. Now, what about the God of the Bible? Well, the God of the Bible is certainly consistent with the evidence, the kind of God the evidence points to. Okay. But we have to take a further step because what we've got from the evidence is our certain characteristics of God, that this God is going to be a personal God because only a personal God can initiate the series of events that cause the world that we have. You can't have just a series of events. A bunch of dominoes falling into past eternity because you'll never get to this moment if that were the case. There's a number of arguments to demonstrate that. And basically, you can't accomplish an actual infinite by successive addition. Or another simpler way of putting it is you can't count to eternity. You can count forever and ever and ever, which is a long time. You can count for a never-ending amount of time, but wherever you are, you will always have a number. You will never have an infinite amount. And this is the line of thinking that indicates the past can't stretch into the history can't stretch into the past without ending, because that would mean that this moment is the terminus of an infinite number of counted events in history, which is not possible, obviously. So there had to be a beginning. Now, so our God is certainly consistent with that, the beginning, who is a person, an agent, who is powerful and smart. And our God is the moral standard of the universe. That's our doctrine, and that would fit for the moral argument. So we're pretty close, aren't we? Now, this is where you have to make another step. And given that some kind of monotheistic understanding of God is going to be required to explain reality as it actually is, there are pretty much only three contenders, and that is the Christian God, the Jewish God, or the Muslim God. And it turns out, arguably, and very convincingly, I think, that the Jewish and the Christian God are the same God, even though Judaism and Christianity has different beliefs about that God. They could be different. This is the same individual falling under different descriptors. Okay? Lots of people might know your spouse, but they would describe the same person in different ways. I think the Muslim characterization of God is actually, arguably, describing a different kind of individual, and significantly different in ways that really matter, even though the claim may be that their belief is in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Demonstrating that that is the God of their belief is a different matter, and I don't think it is. But so basically you have two gods to choose from unless you want to go to Zoroastrianism, which is a monotheistic religion, and Ahura Mazda is the god of that religion. But doesn't it seem to make sense that if God is going to reveal himself, he's going to reveal himself in probably one of the more prominent expressions of that? And this is where, you know, the God of the Bible is one, and then there's further lines of evidence to demonstrate that the God of the Bible is the God who is the true God. I'm not going to get into that now, but so I do think it's impossible for there not to be a God, and whether it's my God or not, I think it is beyond a reasonable doubt that the God of Scripture is the true God. well, at least in my view, or else I wouldn't be a Christian. But that is something that there's a larger error bar for me regarding. Okay, let's move on to another question. We spent more than half our time on just this one, but it's an important one. And this goes to one of the issues I talked about. Now, this is a person who identifies themselves anonymously. The other questions have names. And when I read this, when I read the question, it just, well, let me just read it and you can judge for yourself. If you think that the moral argument for God is a good one, what do you base that off of? What I mean is, considering that most of Western moral philosophy is non-theistic and most academic philosophers today do not agree that God is necessary for morality, what argument or explanation do you declare that all secular moral theories are false? Now, the way this is worded and the spirit in which it's asked, I'm presuming, I'm just reading a little into this, I suspect this is an atheist that's raising the question. And part of the reason is I've had challenges to this before. I give the moral argument, and then I get atheists that will respond, well, who are you to say, kind of thing, and that's how this starts. If you think that the moral argument for God is a good one, what do you base that off of? And how is it that I can declare that all secular moral theories are false? Well, you don't base an argument off of anything. The argument is the basis for the view. And so if one person has given an argument and the question then becomes, what is the argument based on? It is evidence that the person asking the question has not considered the argument. Because if the argument itself is not a good one, it can only fail in one of three ways. It's either not valid because its form is wrong, or its premises are in error, or the argument has terms in it that are ambiguous or used in equivocal ways. Like, for example, Jesus is God, God is a Trinity. God is a Trinity, Jesus is God, therefore Jesus is a Trinity. Okay? Well, that's not right, but it's hard to tell what's not right about it until you realize that the word is, God is a Trinity, that's the is of essential predication, and Jesus is God, let me back up. The second one is the is of essential predication, and the other is a different kind of is. There's an equivocation there, so it's a fallacious charge or argument meant to show that Christianity is absurd. In any event, if somebody wants to fault an argument, they can do so that way, but they don't ask what's it based on because the argument is the basis. I think you follow that, okay? And then the appeal is to all Western moral philosophy is non-theistic. Most of Western moral philosophy is non-theistic. That may or may not be true. I suspect since the Enlightenment it is, but not before the Enlightenment. Virtually every single philosopher in the history of philosophy, and there's like a 10-volume set that tracks it with all the players. Copleston is the author of it, Frederick Copleston. Virtually everyone before the Enlightenment was a biblical theist, okay? And most academic, according to the charge here, philosophers today do not agree that God is necessary for morality, then what argument or explanation, well, that's what I've given, is the moral argument, there it is, do you declare that secular moral theories are false? Look at, if the moral argument goes through, then the secular theories are false, period. Because the secular theories are characteristically trying to explain the moral project without reference to God. That's why there's secular theories on morality. How do we make sense of what we're doing when we do morality but not bring God into the picture? Now, it happens to be that most Western philosophers since the Enlightenment hold to a secular moral philosophy. Are they right or are they wrong? Well, you can't figure out if they're right or wrong by counting heads. You've got to offer an argument. And so I offer an argument, and it's called the moral argument. And if the moral argument is a good one, then all of these current Western secular moral theorists are mistaken. By rational exclusion, not because I'm just declaring them to be so. And if they are not mistaken, that means their way of characterizing morality is better than my way, which is based on the moral argument. And if it's better than the moral argument, it's because the moral argument is flawed, and then you have to show where it's flawed. So this kind of what I take to be sniping at the moral argument in the way that this questioner has done, it's completely illegitimate. The moral argument as I've offered, I think, is a good one. If it's not, then find something wrong with it. And it doesn't matter how many current moral philosophers adopt secular views, because we had most moral philosophers before the Enlightenment adopting theistic views. You don't count heads in this. You count reasons. You look at the reasons. That's what matters. And that's at the heart, by the way, of the Rhodes Scholar Tactic, if you're familiar with the tactical game plan and the tactical approach in the book, Tactics, a Game Plan for Discussing Your Christian Convictions, a book I highly recommend, even though it was written by me. I still think it's a good one, and you need it. But this is an example of that. Rhodes Scholar Tactics says it doesn't matter what the scholars say. What matters is why they say it. What are their reasons? Okay? And so that's all I have to say about that one for now. All right, here comes the premier question. Did Adam and Eve have a belly button? I don't think I've ever been asked that question on a show, but I've been asked the question before, and it's the kind of question that lots of times kids ask, but adults ask it too. I wonder. So here's the answer. You ready? Drum roll, please. No, they did not have a belly button. Why would they? Belly buttons are not essential to being human. It's a scar that's a result of a birth that didn't happen in their case. And so if you didn't have the event, you don't have the scar representing the event. Now, since Adam and Eve, and Adam was the only man made out of dirt, and Eve the only one made out of rib, they didn't need belly buttons because they didn't have them because there was no cause of them. It's not, you don't need a belly button. It's a result of something else. Doesn't fulfill a function. It's the evidence of a prior function which didn't apply to them. So, no, they didn't have belly buttons. What is your view of determinism as opposed to libertarian free will? And I just want to briefly get into this. I think that some things are determined and some things are free. I think human beings operate in both areas. A free act is one that we do ourselves, and classically the way it's characterized, it's not just one we choose ourselves of our own will, but it is one that we could have chose otherwise. That's the CDO condition. And that's what identifies a free act from one that is determined, okay? I personally am not satisfied with these two categories, and because I think there are other kinds of actions that are not captured in these two alternatives. And I'll tell you one of them that I think is deeply misunderstood by people who make arguments in favor of libertarian freedom or free will, is, which I believe in, you know, under a variety of circumstances. I do not think that our salvation is one that we choose as a result of a libertarian action. I'm Reformed in that regard. I think God monergistically works that in us. How he does that, what the nature of that is another question, but I think God's responsible for that. We are not the prime mover. We are not the decisive factor in that. However, just to give another example, and that is often brought up, is I do not think that when we are, I'm going to have to qualify this, having love for other people, loving other people, and I'm thinking specifically about the not the action to be nice when you don't feel like it. I think that is a kind of love. I think that's what Jesus was talking about when he talked about the Good Samaritan and loving your neighbor, that you treat your neighbor with the same kind of goodwill that you treat yourself. That's love as goodwill. And sometimes that's a love we act out. And sometimes that's the love we have in our marriage and with our kids. When the other kind of love that it happens in a different way fails us. So you're in a marriage or your children or other kinds of relationships, and man, it's not happening. You're not feeling it. You're feeling something way different. But what do? You choose to be loving in a circumstance where you don't feel loving. All right, I understand that distinction. But when a person gets married, they are not choosing to do something loving when they don't feel loving. They are feeling loving. They are feeling in love with. They have love for this individual person, their fiancé, and this is why they make this commitment for the rest of their lives to serve and be together and to have and to hold and to cherish, whether or not in that moment they continue to feel love. For better or for worse, for sickness or health, richer or poorer. So you make a promise that covers those other times, but the love that drives you to that decision is not something you chose. Some of you have children. I ask, when did you start loving your child? Right away. Did you look in the bassinets there in the delivery room and say, I'll just find one to choose to love? No, you're looking for the one that is yours because that is where the love is going to be poured out on without effort by you and without decision. Love, true love, is not a function of freedom. But I don't think it's determined in a machine-like kind of way because determinism I consider as machine-like. Something else is going on that's full and legitimate and genuine and real, even though it's not a free choice. And this is why I do not use the love requires a free choice in order to be real. Therefore, that's why God gave us free choices. And that's why Reformed theology or classical Calvinistic type election must be false, because there's no real love in that. This is not true. I think this is a mischaracterization. So I believe in both determinism regarding some things, because the world does operate by consistent natural processes and things, and that includes our physical body is subject to that, and our brains are also subject to that. When a big noise goes off and I jump, I did not choose that. That action was determined by chemical reactions and outside stimuli, not by my choice. All right? So that's determined. But other things I choose to do. I'm choosing to do a radio show now when I could have done otherwise. But I also chose to marry my wife because of something going on inside of me that I didn't choose to do. I chose to marry her, but I didn't choose to love her. And the same is true with my daughters. I love them from a different place than my will. Though many times my will must be employed to act loving towards them when I don't feel like it. And that's called virtue. All right? Okay, last question. Oh, wait a minute, two more. Can I do this? Yeah. Very quickly, what is your view of do people of all denominations go to heaven? Okay. Simply put, in answer, in response, denominations don't go to heaven. or people in denominations don't go to heaven in virtue of denominations. Maybe it's a better way of putting it. But I think really what the question entails is that can you be a genuine believer in any denomination? And I think the answer to any Christian denomination, any truly Christian denomination, and that would exclude Christian Science, it would exclude LDS, Mormonism, it would exclude the Jehovah's Witnesses. I almost said the knock on your door people, but more than one kind of person does that. So because these reject the core defining elements of classical Christianity. So they are different religions. And I'm not putting them down. They may be very nice people and usually are. They may be very good people by human standards, and they may even be right with regards to their theology for the sake of discussion. I'm just simply saying that's not Christian. That's all I'm saying at this point. But when it comes to Christian denominations that hold to classical Christianity, then there could be people in all sorts of denominations that exercise the appropriate faith, trust in Jesus in order to receive the forgiveness that he offers. And if they receive the forgiveness, then they go to heaven. All right? So people go to heaven based on trust. Now, I think that there are denominations that have within them teachings that mitigate against that kind of trust. And I think Roman Catholic Church would be an example of that. But I also think there are a lot of Protestant denominations that do the same thing, that are de facto works-based salvation churches, denominations. And even though they have language that sounds like Jesus being the Savior and he forgives your sins, etc., etc., I was raised Roman Catholic and Jesus didn't forgive my sins. The priest did. The priest forgave my sins when I went into that little box and came out. And so it's a very different kind of situation, all right? And like I said, I'm not picking on Catholics. There's lots and lots of Protestant denominations that, as denominations, as doctrinally driven organizations, they have beliefs that severely mitigate against biblical faith. Okay, but even so, you can be in those organizations and still have the real McCoy. All right. Last question. Fine-tuning argument is like shuffling cards and getting a random combination. What's your response? The fine-tuning argument is like shuffling cards and getting a random combination. What is your response? Okay, well, let's stick with the card illustration. I don't think that's true because the fine-tuning argument entails more than just complexity. If you shuffle the deck of cards at any time and come up with any order through shuffling them, you have randomness. Every hand of cards that's properly shuffled is going to be random. Okay? But the fine-tuning argument isn't just that you have an unlikely complex set of circumstances. And by the way, let me back for a moment. Go back. I need to add more to random. I said it'll be random. That means it's not designed, and it will be complex. So any order of cards is going to have complexity. And the fine-tuning argument isn't that you have complexity and therefore it can't be random, because random events happen all the time that have complexity. The fine-tuning argument entails not one element, complexity, but two elements. Specified complexity. That is, the complexity is specified to a certain outside pattern that it conforms to. So let me go back to cards again. Let's just say that I shuffle the deck and then I deal out a hand. And in the hand that I deal, whatever hand that I deal, it is certainly complex. These different order of cards. and I look at my hand and I have a royal flush, 10, jack, queen, king, ace in a row, all the same suit, hearts. Wow, that's the highest hand you can have in poker. And I got it, and people do get it. It happens. It's random. It's complex, but it's random. It happened by accident. It wasn't cheating. Wow, lucky me. So I get everything. I bet it down. I win the whole pile, right? Okay, we deal out another hand. Guess what? The next hand, what does Coco get? Another natural royal flush, right? Two in a row? Really, what are the chances? Maybe, not very likely. Third hand, Coco gets another royal flush. Is anybody going to believe at this point that I am dealing out these cards randomly and have a complex organization that just is random that gives me natural royal flush three times in a row? I don't think so. Because now this complexity is specified to an outside pattern. And when it's done again and again and again, it is a hallmark of design. He's cheating. He's stacking the deck. Just think of Mount Rushmore. There is all kinds of complexity there in those rocks. But one set of complex forms turn out to be specified against another pattern, which is prior precedence. You can look at a whole long string of numbers, just a massive string of numbers. There they all are. You say, look, well, this is obviously it's a complex set of numbers, obviously, and random. I'm just looking at them. It's just numbers. Unless you discovered that every single one of those numbers was basically the Social Security numbers of every senator in the U.S. Senate in alphabetical order, just put next to each other. They would look random, but you would realize, oh, these aren't random at all. And if that was the case, Social Security numbers, then that would be evidence of design. Unmistakable evidence of design. And that's the way the design argument works. And specifically here, making reference to things like the DNA double helix and the information therein. Oh, well, there's lots of complexity there, but it's not just complexity. It is specified complexity. And by the way, this is a contribution that William Dembski has made to the field, clarifying what specified complexity happens to be. The argument from design, and particularly fine-tuning, is not simply that there is complexity in the constants of the universe, the physics of the universe, or details about the solar system that make it possible for there to be complex life on Earth. It is that the complexity seems to be specified to a different outside external pattern, and that is the hallmark of design. So there you go. I mean, lots I covered in the last almost full hour now, and I hope for those people who listened to the first Facebook Live and got a little bit of this and a little bit of that, but a whole lot of jumble, my apologies. And I hope you're able to catch this particular broadcast because there's some really good things here for you. I hope that you're able to make sense of this. These questions here are good ones. They represent particular kinds of challenges against Christian theism, and some from people who are just wondering, scratching their head. Others from what apparently turn out to be at least ideologically hostiles, that they don't agree with me, and this is one reason they put the word anonymous in there instead of their name. That's okay, I'm not offended, but I hope that what I've shown is so much of these issues need to be worked out carefully in a thoughtful fashion, and you are not going to be able to accomplish that with the same kind of depth or content that I have, but I think the basic ideas are pretty accessible. I give a lot of information here, but I try to throw the ball so people can catch it. And Big Bang needs a big banger, for example. A moral lawmaker, rather, a moral law needs a moral lawmaker. Design needs a designer. Those are very simple ways of characterizing those three basic arguments that I've offered for the existence of God, which compel me really to believe in his existence and to believe in the impossibility of his non-existence. And when I say compel me, you know, people don't choose their beliefs. You don't just, oh, I'll believe this today or that today. You are confronted with things and the beliefs spring upon you. You are confronted with facts or information or circumstances, and then you immediately form beliefs about those things that are tied to the information. And when you change your beliefs, when new information is presented, okay, that's a rejection of what philosophers call doxastic voluntarism. We don't voluntarily believe what we believe. This seems pretty obvious to most philosophers. But as we get more information, we get to choose how we are to act on the beliefs of things that seem reasonable. And what I offer as a Christian apologist, as a defender of the truth, is a series of evidences collected oftentimes in syllogistic argument form for you to consider. And the argument is the argument. It either works or it doesn't. The argument isn't based on anything else. It is itself the rationale. And if you think it fails, I'm happy to see where it fails. I don't think these fail, which is why I'm a Christian. And I think the issue matters. It's weighty. There's gravity to it, which is why I'm a Christian apologist. It's important to defend the truth that really makes a difference. And there's nothing more important than what we've been talking about here. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Thanks so much for being part of the show. Give him heaven this week.